Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and I'm joined on the line by Mark. How are you, Mark?
Great, Mike.
This week we travel back 10,000 BC to an era of incredibly good digital hair simulation in the movie 10,000 BC.
Yeah, they were evidently much better at that way back then.
Yeah, definitely. So look, I guess as we always do, to start with finding out whether you enjoyed the film or not.
I had tremendous appreciation for this film as a visual effects movie. I think that Roland Emmerich is, if you're a visual effects geek, which I don't necessarily think of myself as all the time, but I do think that this is a guy who's assembled a team and thinks about constructing movies in terms of doing pretty impressive things visually. And it sounds like with this one, he gave the artists a chance to really kind of do their work. And so, you know, since this show is not about critiquing the film in dramatic terms, I think that from a visual effects standpoint, I think it's pretty strong.
Actually, I must say, I didn't mind the film from a visual effects standpoint. I thought it was, you know, good, basically. I thought that what was interesting about it was that, you know, they were seeing some pretty amazing hair sims on the woolly mammoths and stuff, and some pretty good now I would say massive, but I got in trouble over this before because it isn't actually massive.
They have their own sim, right?
But yeah, so let's get some of the facts down. Do you want to tell us about who actually contributed to the shots?
Yeah, the main houses on this one were both in London, Double Negative and MPC, I believe, were the big two. And after that, most of the other houses that worked on this seemed to be, from what I could gather, small and much more specialized.
Yeah, from what I can gather, you know, it was pretty well split with MPC doing the woolly mammoths primarily. And we had a story on that actually on FX Guide. So I guess I feel more comfortable talking about that almost than anything else. So as that led the film as well, it was like, you know, the opening kind of dramatic sequence. Do you want to discuss that? What did you think of the elephant-esque mammoths?
The mammoths are really pretty impressive. I think they're also, in many ways, they're crucial to the story of this film. They're symbolic somehow of, I don't know, nature and enslavement and danger. And anyway, they definitely had to be real for the story to work. And they may have been, I mean, in terms of what I thought was really pretty seamlessly effective, they might have been the strongest, I don't know, creature work in the film. What'd you think, Mike?
Yeah, no, I definitely thought that. I mean, there was some very, I guess let's start with being negative and I'll go positive in a second.
The
only thing that I wasn't sold on, and I know it came directly from the director because I was told that by the visual effects supervisor, was the way that the mammoths ran, because they wanted them to gallop. And elephants, I think, basically always have 3 feet on the ground at any one time. So having them sort of gallop is a hard thing to then also make them look heavy, bulky, and huge.
Yeah, I mean, well, given that, it's certainly, I didn't have as big a problem with their weight or mass or really even the movement as, you know, I can think of other examples where the animators didn't get such a difficult brief. And, you know, I mean, so that didn't bother me so much. Some of the interaction between the actors and then was really impressive, a la, I mean, I think in many ways this film picks up where Golden Compass left off with its Oscar in terms of making creatures interact subtly with complex environments, in this case, not only humans, but, you know, grasslands and, you know, pretty complex environment. You know, I couldn't stand doing dialogue while being dragged along by the net behind the mammoths. But that was really nothing to do with the mammoths themselves. It was just part of that sequence that, you know, I just, something about it seemed so utterly artificial and filmic. It was hard to imagine having a discussion while being dragged by a mammoth.
So the technical aspects of it that, for those that haven't read FX Guide story, is that the woolly mammoths, first of all, had incredibly long hair. So they had hair that was, by the metrics of the film, about 2 meters long. So that's hard, right? Because you got very... I mean, basically, it's a variation on a particle system, a hair system. The longer the hairs, the harder they are. But the real fun got going when that hairy object had to interact with a net made of, you guessed it, woolly mammoth hair in front of grass, which, you guessed it, was made by the same hair program, effectively now running as grass. So you had an enormous amount of the screen that was coming from complex CG simulation work, because after all, that's what hair is. And I thought that stuff was just brilliant.
Yeah, also, they weren't able to do just a hair simulation because the hair had to have all these clumpy pieces of mud in it, right?
Yeah, so they had to have lots of sort of... and depending on what age or environment they were in, it was dust if when it was in the later scenes and mud in the earlier scenes. But yes, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, so they had to kind of combine what might, under other circumstances, be two totally different systems of animation.
Yeah, well, the thing that also was interesting is they came up with some really clever solutions for getting the mammoth's hair to interact with either the hair that they were running into, the hair nets they were running into, which were effectively ropes, or the actual kind of, what you'd call it really, the harness that they wore in the later scenes where they were enslaved effectively doing the work on the pyramids. And they actually came up with a ambient occlusion solution to that, which I thought was really clever in the sense that they worked out that in the same way in an ambient occlusion pass that you have, of course, a darkening whenever you've got sort of a seam or a crease or a two objects close together. So too would you have the same effect of the harness near the hair. If the hair wasn't near a rope, it would have no ambient occlusion. If it was near a rope, it would have ambient occlusion. And they actually got the ambient occlusion pass with direction vectors to feed into flattening or not flattening the hair. And it was a big, in one sense it's a hack, but in another sense it was an absolutely brilliant piece of lateral thinking.
Yeah, and from what I could gather, that those extra passes carried over into Comp 2, so the Shake compositors actually got some passes that also had some normals data in them, so they could do some of the 3D-like stuff there as well. I don't know if that applies directly to the... I mean, what you're talking about is more along the lines of, you know, doing collision stuff, but...
Well, it's sort of, I mean, you know, you are right. Like, what you've got is basically the dynamics of the animation. So you've got the animation of the nude mammoth, effectively, right? Got to animate to look like it is struggling with the rope. Then you can stick the ropes over the top of it, which is like a cloth sim problem. How does the net hang over the mammoth? But then how does the net push down the hair, and where does it push it down? As you say, a complex collisions problem. And trying to get all of that working perfectly with the hair would have been really, really hard. So they got it working with the effectively naked mammoth, and then the hair was affected by the ambient occlusion. In other words, they realized that something over here to the left, if speaking metaphorically, that's going to exhibit the same kind of information or data or properties that this other thing on the right. And so rather than calculating on the right, they just used what they learnt from the left, fed it into the right, and so it went. In other words, they took something that wasn't designed for it and fed it across the network effectively to get that solution. And that's the kind of lateral thinking that there's a difference between the film industry, I think, and, you know, sort of just a pure SIDGRAPH paper on the physics of how something should work. Because the bottom line was, you know, it looked great, and it looked great because they were clever about it and stopped, you know, because the renders on these, are, you know, even without that collision problem, were massive. I mean, they really did seriously weigh down their own render farms at MPC. Yep. So, yeah.
I guess they also had to even add... I mean, I don't think they were anticipating modeling a lot of grass. They were planning to use what they had from the shoot, and I take it that didn't quite work out. It turned into...
Well, no, because you see the... Roto. Yeah, exactly. You'd have such a hard job rotoing the grass behind the feet of the woolly mammoth, and then add insult to injury, you wouldn't have the interaction you'd expect, like them obviously flattening the grass. But having said that, apparently on set, they were like art directing individual blades of grass practically to get the framing of what they wanted in the foreground and whatever. So when they digitally removed the grass and put new stuff back, it wasn't a rough pass. This was a meticulously done blade of grass kind of thing. And this is all using the in-house hair sim thing they call Fertility. And I must admit, I thought Fertility was a particularly amusing name for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they got a few funny ones there.
They have, haven't they? But yeah, because the other one was the crowd simulation stuff, which their crowd thing, which you alluded to earlier, isn't massive, though most people would think of it as being massive, because that's certainly one of the first massive crowd sim programs. And I think MPC actually used Massive on that famous, remember the, I think it was the Xbox, or it might have been PlayStation 3 ad, where all the people formed a human mountain in the heart of London? Just throwing themselves. I think it was one of the first commercials done with Massive. Anyway, the guys at MPC went away and wrote their own thing called Alice. And I've got no idea why it's called Alice, but their crowd sim program provided, 30,000, 40,000 something slaves in the actual set of the Gaza sequence.
Yeah, and you know, about that sequence, I was looking at that, and I mean, I think a lot of us can look at a shot and still discern, you know, with a big exterior like that, one can discern whether it's CG, a matte painting, or a model. I mean, if it's a mixture of all three, it can be trickier, but fundamentally, especially if it's CG or a physical model, it's usually still possible, I think, to kind of tell the difference. That, you know, I was looking at it thinking, well, that's a model. That's a really good physical model they built for this. So how did they get all these thousands of people running up and down it? And it turns out that they, you know, they photographed it, first of all, with this really cool, what's it called? The spider cam?
The spider cam is actually the remote control, you know, it's like a camera on wires. We've probably seen them at football games, right? Like the same.
Oh, okay. Is that all right. It seemed like it was maybe a more miniature version of the same thing, but maybe I'm just imagining that. Because they did, the set they built for it was evidently huge, right? It was hundreds.
Spider cam was developed for either by or for Sony Imageworks Spider-Man stuff to allow you have, you know, three-dimensional stuff. But yeah, the actual set, which was built in pieces, I believe in Munich, was enormous. Like, and that was the, you know, the vast model. But again, as you say, they didn't actually use that model. Well, they did. They used it indirectly.
They did. Well, they used it and then they reprojected it in 3D, right? So that they could, I mean, what I got from that is that I didn't hear motion tracking, but I thought that it was sort of a doing the live shoot and then using the visuals of the model with the CG matched to it that way. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, well, when we were talking to the visual effects supervisor on that, he said that basically they intended to use that model. They intended just to film it, and it was going to be pretty much as you'd expect. And then they went, well, hang on a second, if we've got to populate this model, we're going to need to put them behind all this scaffolding and in this scaffolding, and all this scaffolding is really, really small. Like, it's got down to, like, you know, 1 pixel or less. So how are we going to roto all that? And it became the same kind of problem as the grass with the feet, though slightly less obvious. And so then they went, well, if we reproduce this completely as a CG model, then we'd be able to put them in there and get them behind things for free. And, of course, that sounded like a good idea until we realized that, you know, it has to be as photoreal as the original plates, which everyone was very happy with offset. So they, again, remodeled the whole environment based on the really good work that the, I think it was Gary, I'm trying to remember his name, Gary from MPC was their on-set supervisor. He photographed the whole thing. And so they used that to reproduce the model. But then, as it was, as I think you just said, project over the original stills so that you have the real textures, the real everything from the day, but now with a 3D model textured with the live action plate of the miniature model. If that's not too confusing. And all of a sudden you've got all the realism for the model, but the computer graphics for the instant auto roto.
Yeah, it really tests my assertion that one can still kind of sense when one is looking at a real physical object in terms of an environment versus a simulation, because it really kind of blurs the lines, right?
Well, I just think it'd be really funny if you were like, imagine you're like Bob, and like Bob's job is to rebuild the 1/24th scale thing that they built in Munich, right? So Bob packs it all up, ships it all over to friggin' Nairobi or somewhere, sets the whole thing up, rebuilds it, gets it perfect, and then goes to the cinema, and they go, oh, no, we didn't actually use that, Bob. You could have just left it in Munich, and we'd have just photographed it there. But, you know, no, great job, mate. Really good. No, tops. You'd be like, you did what? I went all the way over there for nothing. But, yeah, I mean, it was, you know, it was a great set. And, again, the woolly mammoths appeared there, though now sort of made to look hot and suffering from, you know, the sort of heat aspects of being in a dusty environment as opposed to the kind of muddy environment we'd seen them in earlier.
Yeah, I didn't... Sometimes there wasn't quite enough dust. The comps would have actually sold themselves a little better as they're stampeding around if they had been kicking up more of a... dust storm. That did occur to me, you know, watching them, thinking, well, what's not quite right about this?
One of the things that I found that wasn't an NPC shot, and I don't know who did it, but one bit that really I had a problem with, which is completely changing the subject, is, you know, we've discussed the beginning of the film, we discussed the end, we've discussed that they were in this kind of mountainous area. At some point, they moved from the mountainous area, which seemed like it was covered in snow, into a tropical rainforest, and it felt to me like they took, you know, here we are in the, you know, never ending, oh wait, it just ended, now we're in a tropical rainforest. It's like, wait a second, where did that come from?
Well, there was a lot in this film to undermine the sense of realism about things like that. The way the people all kind of slept, just lying down on skins in their supposedly freezing cold environment, didn't seem quite right. You know, they're all kind of lying around in a big room together, and that didn't seem right. And yeah, then they take off on this adventure wearing basically t-shirts and end up instantly in a tropical forest. That kind of undermined it. I also, actually, from a storytelling point of view, I mean, you know, Roland Emmerich, going back to the spider cam, I mean, the equivalent that he also really likes to use is a helicopter shot. The guy loves a good helicopter shot, and which is really cool. You know, there were some beautiful exteriors and, you know, swooping approaches, and it really showed off, for example, the mammoths really well. But... you know, it seems almost anachronistic, right? Because it's a prehistoric film with really sophisticated helicopter movement. And despite that they were really, you know, on the one hand, I mean, Uli Steiger and his team, they were really disciplined about only using natural light. And they didn't do the kind of camera moves that, you know, you hate, Mike, where it's the impossible zoom or you know, the track shot that just makes you think about the camera. But in a sense, a helicopter shot is that shot. I mean, it does make you think, wow, we're really flying smoothly over this, you know, we're, I don't know, did you get that sense at all that it, you know, maybe the film, I mean, I don't want to go so far as to say the film would have been better served by, like, all handheld. I don't really know where to go with this.
Yeah, sort of, I guess. It didn't bother me an enormous amount. I mean, I sort of know what you mean. I must admit, though, when they did the shot of the river with the sails, which obviously was one of those helicopter shots, I was like, oh, that's a good shot. I mean, that, and I know that that was a double negative shot, I'm pretty sure. And, you know, the boats looked good, the water looked great, the cloth sims on the sails looked magnificent, and I would have been felt cheated had I not had the majestic nature of that shot from a wide. So I don't know, maybe a less moving, you know, aerial, in other words, like an establishing kind of aerial without the kind of, you know, swooping and flying thing. I'm very glad we didn't have pterodactyls and other kind of... What did you think of the saber-toothed tiger?
Yeah, I thought we were going to move on to that. So that was, so speaking of double negative, they, I guess, hadn't really done a lot of creature work previous to this. I mean, the last time they came up on this show that I know of was for New York in Cloverfield, which I think they were, you know, that's maybe more typical of the type of stuff they've done. Does that seem true? I mean, they
certainly have got very good building environment. No, they did that 9/11 film And they also did, of course, the Batman stuff. So, yeah.
So, I guess, you know, in doing the research on this, it seemed like they regarded it as an opportunity to, you know, strut their stuff and try something. And they tried something really challenging, actually. I mean, Sabretooth Tiger, but also Sabretooth Tiger drowning, right? So, like, Sabretooth Tiger underwater.
Yeah, let's make it really bad.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, to be honest, I started watching that sequence thinking, well, that's one of the Patrick Tatopoulos, you know, I mean, that's physical, you know, it's old school. And then I realized, of course, the thing was too expressive to be that. And I couldn't, you know, I'd have to go back and look again to see if there were any physical models in it. But clearly, at some point in the close-ups, they had this, you know, expressive creature that had to also be drowning so that the guy could save it and then, you know, set up what some people have called the least probable thing in the whole movie, which is that he befriends the saber tooth. But, you know, I was pretty convinced by that specific challenge. I mean, and that, again, when I was talking about Golden Compass, you know, having done all this tricky stuff with multiple interactions, I mean, this seems like breaking kind of new ground of putting a creature in close up in water like that.
I wasn't 100% sold on the tiger design. Patrick Tatopoulos'
stuff. Yeah, cheated, right?
Yeah, I just didn't feel. Yeah, but having said that, I thought the wet fur sims and the fur over the muscle stuff that they did at D-Neg was magnificent. I mean, they were really, really good. I just, the face was still, you know, I don't know, I spent a lot of time looking at my dog's face, I guess. They're quite expressive.
And, see. Well, that I mean, that could be the flip side of how I thought at first it must be, you know, a physical model. And it does make me wonder whether it's still in the territory where you could have maybe pulled that off without going CG with it. But on the other hand, I mean, you know, I didn't look at the water and think, oh, well, that doesn't look right, or that looks like a simulation.
With the exception of the galloping of the mammoths, at least we didn't have, you know, a cat jumping all over the pyramids through 15 windows and flying, leaping and breaking, you know, many laws of physics. I mean, there was a trapped animal and it tended to bounce from things to thing, but they kept the realism there. And even as the slaves revolted, there was a sense that, you know, there really wasn't the ability to run up and down a pyramid three times and not lose your breath.
Yeah, that's
pretty good spear throwing.
There were a couple of Tigger moments for the saber tooth, but really only a couple. For the most part, yeah, he seemed to have the right weight and so on. What about those birds?
Yeah, what's up
animation
with the birds?
Yeah, well, they didn't. Yeah, it seems surprising that they're that fierce since they look like a bunch of ostriches done larger.
Like, right? Turkeys, yeah. I know, it was weird, you know, because, like, if that had been velociraptors, I mean, it was pretty scary, but it was, the less we saw of them, the scarier it was.
Well, and we didn't see much of them, and actually, dramatically, that worked pretty well, right? Like, having the eye appear in the grass, and, I mean, actually, they did themselves a real favor by putting in grass. It reminded me a little bit of that, you know, Lost World sequence that did a similar thing, like created this menace because you didn't know where, you know, you could hear it instead of see it. You could hear it as much as you could see it. And, you know, visual effects artists always like that.
See, here's an interesting thing, right? And I think that I'm going to completely segue out of this film for a second, but there's an interesting point about how much you give the audience and how much you don't know what's going on. See, mm-hmm. in one of the raptor scenes from one of the Jurassic sequences, there was a great shot of a lot of grass, and there was like rustling of grass, and you could see the rustles forming a pattern, which was obviously the pack of the... And that scared the bejillikins out of me, and it established a relationship between the raptors and our heroes, where in this I felt like, I don't know where anyone's coming from. I understand the confusion thing, but I saw a movie last night which was Vanishing Point. Have you seen that?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so Actually, there's another thing I mentioned on Vanishing Point. But in that, there was a chase sequence, right? So similar kind of problem. You've got out of control, multiple cameras, things darting in and out. And it, in the same sense as that bird thing, I just gave up trying to work out the geography. Do you know what I mean? I just went, you know what? I got no idea where anything's coming from. Somebody's hitting something. Something's jumping over something. You know, I don't consider myself a visually illiterate person, but there's just not enough there on first pass to work out which way is up.
Yeah.
Though I'll tell you something really interesting.
Well, I mean, I think that's a really pretty astute observation, because dramatically it's true. I was impressed by the actual animation in that sequence. I mean, I thought they moved really well, and, you know, they had this, you know, I mean, they were menacing when they actually struck, but it's true in terms of anticipation and kind of the dramatic quality of it, it didn't really do that. Interesting thing about that is, from what I gather, I mean, the most of the sequences like that were set up pretty elaborately by a good-sized previs team. And, you know, they did that thing where they could put a bunch of cameras around and kind of do a little, you know, sort of try it out, Chinese menu, you know, which camera do I want to use here in pre-production. And I wonder if the luxury of that, you know, can sometimes cause one not to think so much about constructing something more specific.
I mean, I like a bit of the old, we're ahead of the character a bit, like, don't go around the corner, you know, don't go in there, you know, kind of thing.
That's right.
And I don't know that, I know that may be a cheat, but it worked really well in I Am Legend, and I scared the bajillikins out of me in the dark scene. That,
yep.
Hey, something else I want to talk to you about in, because I just have to get this off my chest, because I thought it was phenomenally interesting, and it's really not visual effects, but it certainly is storytelling. In Vantage Point, the premise is that the same event is watched from the perspective of, I don't know, seven different people, right? So you see an assassination, and then it rewinds, and then you see the assassination again from a different point of view, and rewind, and it does it again, right? And the idea is that every time you learn something new, and every time something that you had assumed to be the case is no longer the case, right? So I don't think I'm giving anything away, because it's in the trailer when I say that the assassination doesn't kill the guy, right? And so you don't see that. First time through, you think the guy's dead, and then the second time through, something's up, and the third time through, you completely understand now that, and then we're on to another plot point. Here's the interesting thing. The audience I was with, and it was, you know, a proper Cineplex with a good crowd because it was just opened, audibly groaned by the second or third time it went back to the beginning, because it felt to them like, oh God, now I have to sit through a whole nother bit just to update the story more. Even though, actually, you were getting a lot of information from seeing it from a different point of view. So it wasn't that you were seeing all the same footage again. You were seeing different footage, different angles on the same event, and learning a lot of new information, right? But it didn't seem to be advancing the story. And as a consequence, the audience, I mean, I've never heard this before. They were actually like really loud. People would go, oh, God, when it went back to the beginning. And I was stunned at this. I mean, the whole audience as a group started laughing every time it went back to the beginning again, because people were just like moaning. And yet, I thought the only thing I can think about this is that psychologically, you want to find out what's going on and you want the story to advance. And going back in time says to me, well, I know this, even though you didn't, right? That was the whole premise of the film. And it was a phenomenally interesting, you know, just a normal audience, not a special preview audience or anyone that's sort of meant to be vocal. It wasn't a uni crowd that had been drinking. They hated having to see it over when they thought they knew what had happened, and they hated the story not advancing. And I think that there's a real lesson there for a filmmaker, is that, you know, if you have a device and the device is so strong as to rewind the story and start over, that the audience just may not go with you. They may just be like, you know what, I want my story to advance. I don't mind you jump back in time to someone's childhood, but I don't want to see this again that I've just seen, even though you could argue that they were getting a different story. Does that make sense?
Yeah, one word, Mike, prequel. Or maybe two words, prequel trilogy. That's what is coming to my mind anyway, as I hear you say that. But yes, I do. And I mean, certainly stories have pulled that off. I mean, Run, Lola, Run was pretty popular film that I don't think too many people groaned at going back through that one. And I think it concealed, I mean, did it conceal? It gave you such a different point of view each time that you didn't quite feel like you were being dragged through anything.
What was the film that was played backwards?
Memento?
Memento. Yeah, Memento. No, that was a magnificent film.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But there, it was the same thing. I was revealing things that I didn't know, as it were. But I did feel like the story was advancing. Like, does that make sense?
Well, you see, yeah, it also presents this kind of psychological phenomenon that the main character of the film is going through. So it really kind of boggles the mind. Like, you don't ever groan because you're continually trying to comprehend what else this guy's going to have to deal with from having no long-term memory.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we don't discuss enough in this show, and maybe it's because it's the VFX show, but not the editing show, but the role of the editor to play that both in those cases, right? So the two examples we've given is understanding the geography of this scene and letting the audience have enough to not be just give up and say, well, I don't know who's coming from where. And then the second one is if you've got a device like we've been discussing, then the editing challenge is almost bigger than any other to pull that off.
Yeah, and that maybe ties into what I was wondering about all the previews, because that wasn't the only sequence in this particular film that threw a lot of action with you without you really being able to know. I mean, you knew which way was up, but you didn't, you know, you're pretty close in on stuff a lot of the time. And, you know, around the pyramids, it also got pretty chaotic at times. And I don't know, maybe, you know, do you suppose maybe the editor didn't get a whole lot to do on this one with it being so kind of blocked out prior to being made? I wonder.
I don't know. It's hard to say. I guess the only thing we...
Or is that even a criterion? You know, I mean, Hitchcock films have great editing and they're meticulously storyboarded and planned out, so...
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's just a need, because I do say that there are films that are almost as harsh, like Bourne Ultimatum, that are very tied in. But, you know, there were chase sequences that I knew how many cars were following, I knew where we were going, I knew that if he hit that thing, the guy would catch him kind of thing. I think it just comes down to is we've upped the ante and made these incredibly fast-paced in editing on a nonlinear editor. And as the audience has got very, very technically literate, we're pushing it hard now. And the responsibility falling on the editor to pull that off and maintain what's going on is like really hard. Because if you go back to Hitchcock stuff, the only sort of, and there are instances of it, like the shower scene, like 40 cuts in what seemed like, you know, 40 frames. But it wasn't a plot sort of arc so much as it was an attack, right? You sort of got the attack and then it flash. But a lot of the other stuff, you know, is relatively slow by today's standards in editing. And so the meticulous storyboarding obviously helped. I don't know. I just think that these days...
The scene you describe, that's an editing tour de force. I mean, they spent 3 or 4 days in the shower just getting little bits of body and scissors and shower curtain and... that one actually really was up to the editor, I think.
Oh, yeah. And Hitchcock himself. But I guess my point is that I didn't need... I could be disorientated. I mean, the shower scene from Psycho, I agree. It's like the definitive, you know... I often say the shower scene from anything, right? I'll be like the shower scene from FX Guide. But my point was that it was okay to be disorientated because it was flashes of knives, flashes of plug holes. And I totally agree. Brilliant editing. And the fact that I felt like I saw more than I did, if you actually play through it, there's actually almost no nudity. It's a remarkable piece of editing. But I didn't mind being disorientated because it's one very short sequence of disorientating attack where I don't think that's as valid with the level of confusion in a chase sequence through a forest where we're trying to keep track of several characters, whether they're alive or dead, and you know, or they're getting separated, and then there are they added the extra thing of the baddies coming after the goodies who have been got after by the monsters kind of thing. And at some point...
Well, and there's also the question of the setup. Like, that shower sequence, I mean, we're going to spend half the show now on Psycho, but, you know, that sequence has a really clear and strong setup. And so when it gets chaotic and cutty, you know, you're oriented around a really strong shot going in. And maybe that shot with the eye that I'm describing is maybe the best candidate. And you didn't really... You had a sense they're in danger, but... You're right about, I mean, where we started with this was that scene from Lost World with how creepy and menacing that, you know, the dinosaurs that you can't see, but you know they're moving through the grass because you see the tracks they're making. I mean, that is some great storytelling, right?
Yeah, I think that was great storytelling. And I think that you do need to give the audience something. I think that it's... And I think it builds the, oh my God, here it comes factor. You know, we don't get enough of, because it's all like, oh, let's surprise them by suddenly having it come out of nowhere. And it's like, well, yeah, but there's something about... The audience doesn't need to be just surprised. It needs to hate the anticipation of seeing the inevitable and wanting the audience to go the other way. And I remember somebody talking about this with a Hitchcock shot where he positioned the camera behind somebody, right? And I read this recently. And the DOP was, this seems the weirdest choice, until he was in a cinema and watched the audience all lean over to the right to almost try and look around the guy's head because you wanted to see what was going on. Do you know what I mean? And he understood that audience participation in the role, that they need, we need to give them enough time and credit. Mm-hmm. And I don't think just, I don't know. I mean, I've got nothing against fast editing.
This goes right back to what I was wondering about doing so much previs with, you know, 16, 18, 24, 36 cameras in the scene. It's kind of covering it like a sports event more than like creating a story in a movie with one camera, which is the traditional discipline. I mean, this is just a theory, and I haven't really thought this out, so I may be totally wrong, but it does strike me that if you, you know, the way you'd cover, say, the Super Bowl with that many cameras, it's not going to leave you with a sense of anticipation. It's going to leave you with the ideal angle to see everything happening. And, you know, if you want to cut in and get right in the action, you can do it. Whatever effect you want, you can do. But you don't get... I mean, it's not really telling you a story. It's not creating anticipation or... I mean, the drama is that it's a live event, not that it's telling a story in the way that a film does.
Switching isn't editing and storytelling. Yeah, I think the narrative arc, you know, we could do more for narrative arcs. And you know what? I mean, when effects are at their best, they're getting me from somewhere and giving me narrative arc, right? It's the same deal. But, yeah, and I think your point about the multiple cameras is absolutely true because... was it a Truffaut? One of the French directors, New Wave guys, did a car chase all on a guy's foot on the brake pedal and the accelerator, and it was magnificent. It was because you couldn't see what was happening, but it was very clear from the audio and what he was doing with his feet how things were going. And these days it'd be like we'd see under the foot, over the foot, atop, from outside the car, flying into the foot, from underneath the road.
Yeah, maybe it's in a storytelling sense, it might be a little bit lazy to do it that way. I mean, I could be, you know, going too far with this, but...
But hell, what are we if we're not, you know...
Yeah, that's our job, right?
Full-time quarterbacks. What is it? The expression that you have in America? Yeah, anyway, I think if we get back to this film for a second, I think that that... You know, kudos to the effects house involved. They did a good job. I think the film deserves to go a bit better than it is. I think it has a bit of a bad rap for some unknown reason. I don't think it's a bad film. I actually liked it and enjoyed it and thought it was good they didn't use name actors, that they tried to, you know, do some cool stuff. And definitely from a pure CG point of view, God, get this out on Blu-ray and check out the detailed work. We have some big frames on FX Guide Story that you can, you know, click on to get sort of zoomed in feature aspects of the pictures. But it really is good work from the guys.
Yeah, hey, absolutely.
One thing I was going to note, I noticed in doing this research, once again, Cyflex Cloth Sim. I don't know if it's you or me, but it seems to me everyone uses Cyflex. Do you know of another major cloth sim outside, you know, the ones that are actually built into Mayer and stuff?
It's not really my area of specialty, so I'm not the best one to ask. But, you know, are you thinking that maybe these companies that did so many other proprietary tools might have...
I just think Cyflex just seems to do the best cloth sim stuff. Everybody seems to use them. And I guess I'm just giving them a shout out because I don't know the guys or anything, but they, you know, from Batman's cape to the boat sails to the netting over these mammoths, you know, it's like whenever you get a really good cloth sim, if you dig a bit deeper, you'll find that they were using Cyflex. And I, as I say, I don't know the guys, but I think they obviously must be doing really, really good work.
Yeah.
I don't know if they've already won a technical Oscar or something. I should look that up. But I just keep on running into them, and didn't know if you did as well, but they do seem to be doing very, very good work.
I wasn't aware that they actually kind of had cornered the market like that.
Maybe they haven't. From the vantage point of one person, which is me, I just seem to notice whenever I find out good cloth sim stuff, I dig up and they seem to be behind it. Thanks for taking time to go back in time. Was there any other points you wanted to touch on before we wrapped up?
You seem to be familiar with the London houses, and we talked before about, you know, how they collaborate on things. I don't know if that was so much the case on this one, but, this one, mostly got done in the UK, and, you know, it all got shot, I guess, down in South Africa. Good work in the, you know, I just wanted to call out that those parts of the world, because they're not always, what we think of.
New Zealand, actually, increasingly, you know, just is home to great, you know, anything that's prehistoric or native, you know.
Well, and then these guys reused the location that Kubrick used in 2001. they went there.
With far more realistic results. As much as we love Kubrick, right?
They didn't have to rear project them.
No, and as we record, I believe today... speaking of 2001, didn't Arthur C. Clarke pass away?
I didn't hear that.
I think he has. If not, I apologize, but I believe I saw that. And not that that's anything to do with Double Negative or the work of MPC, but I'm almost 100% sure that I saw that in the news today. But anyway, I just thought of it because you mentioned that they were, as you say, shooting in that part of the world.
He was 90 years old. You are correct.
So, on that sad note, I will see you, my friend. Are you heading over to Vegas for an AB, or have you got other stuff coming up? Where are you at?
I'm highly likely. I'm getting more committed to it. How about you, Mike?
Yep, we're going over with crew and all and sundry. Should have a good time. Do podcasts and all these other things. I must say, I'm really curious to see. There's good reasons to go because of Scarlett and the new Red camera, but I'm going to miss Apple not being there.
I suppose so. I do kind of, you know, I appreciate the focus on some of the smaller players, especially if the Apples and Avids of the world aren't really going to have much to really show. I'm open to, as long as people like you and our friends show up, I think that's such a big part of what's valuable about going to these things. If it's an indicator that Apple's losing a little bit of interest in their highly successful nonlinear editing and related tools, then that would be more distressing.
Yes. Hey, where can people? What would you like to plug? Let's not beat around the bush here.
I don't need to plug too much. I've had a couple people find me on Facebook, and I totally welcome people to do that. Say hi. I don't use Facebook much, but it seems to be useful for that, to just say, hey, come find me. How about you, Mike? What's going on?
Just the usual stuff. Basically, at FX Guide, we've got a really interesting article that should be posted about the time this goes up on stereoscopic 3D, like the art of digital stereo 3D. I'm talking, when I say 3D, I mean dual cameras. And so I've been working on that for a while, which has been really cool, and been enjoying researching that. So hopefully we can do...
Are you covering any of the new Nuke features that are dedicated to
Nuke and just discussing the principles of it? It's one of those, it's a funny thing, but we just like to not publish press releases and actually write original stories. The trouble is it can take a hell of a long time to actually write. So I guess we do pop up quick things, but we like to write some more in-depth stuff rather than just do the press release stuff. And this is one that I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, everyone appreciates that.
All right. Well, until next time, when Alex may or may not return, depending on where he's at. If you want to check out some of the other podcasts, I can really recommend the This Week in Photography podcast. It's a cracker. Started, I think it's about episode 10 or 11. But it's been really good if you're into photography, and the guys have been doing an outstanding job on that. And there's some weird and wonderful things happening with the studio in San Francisco, so they couldn't join us today. They can't get Skype working out of there. It's funny, you can't get internet out of San Francisco, poor chaps.
The U.S., you know, the irony of the entire U.S. really about where we're at with high-speed communication versus, I don't know, Korea. It's kind
of you've got an inferiority complex when it comes to your broadband.
Well, you don't have to have a complex if it truly is inferior.
Okay, well, using the old form of airplane technology, I'm going to fly over in a couple of weeks, and hopefully I'll see you in Vegas, where the mojitos and the margaritas are on me.
You've given me my reason to go.
And yes, and I'm sure John and the guys are looking forward to seeing you too. And hopefully we'll meet up all the other guys from the various empires, including the Pixel Corps and FX Guide and stuff. But look, I want to thank our producers, as always, on the show. We don't thank those guys enough ever for researching and helping and editing and stuff. And
yeah, they were really flexible. We jumped in on this one fast.
Yeah, so thanks for that, guys. And until next week, this is the VFX Show, and we'll catch you then. Thank you. See you.